Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in one. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Hi, my name is Carolina, and this is my podcast Textory, where we read, analyze, dissect, and laugh at historical texts. And now I'm back with Textory Season 3, baby. So some announcements first. This is the last Textory episode. Drumroll, that's going to show up on my YouTube channel. So basically, I'm moving the podcast to a separate channel because it messes up my channel's algorithm probably, and just it doesn't look good. So if you're listening anywhere else, there will be no changes, so you don't need to worry. But if you're listening on YouTube or YouTube Music, you need to worry. So for the future episodes, any episode after this one, I need you to head to youtube.com/@textorythepodcast, or you can just, you know, throw Textory the podcast into the search bar and hopefully it shows up. You could preferably subscribe, and this is kind of important because otherwise you're probably not going to see the future episodes unless you search for them. So this is a big change. And then, as usual, if you want to support Textory and make sure it keeps going and make sure that new episodes keep coming out, you can head to my Patreon at patreon.com/textory for the stuff that didn't make it into the podcast, for some visual stuff, cool images, interesting discussions, and just fun things. So join us there. If you want sort of a teaser of what you're going to get this season, we are going to delve into a lot of how-tos. Like, there is a lot of guides and books telling people how to live from the past. There is a lot of people's writings, so there is a lot of diaries, letters, etc. But we're also going to do poetry, which I don't think we've done before. We're going to do some pretty gruesome medical texts. And of course, a lot of romance. So this is sort of what we're up to this season. But today, because I'm back at work, we're gonna talk about work, baby. Specifically, we're going to talk about domestic service. So basically, all sorts of stuff that people were hired to do at other people's households. I think it's really interesting how this industry has almost completely died out, and in a short period of time compared to how long it existed. One reason is probably the invention of, you know, household appliances and the rise of people's wages, but it also went from being such a normalized part of society to somehow being almost shunned upon. Like, if your friend that lives alone told you that, you know, they hired someone to do the cleaning for them, you'll probably be like, it's kind of weird, they can't manage on their own. But back then, it was completely normal. If anyone could afford it, they had staff. They had people around a household that were designated for particular household chores. It's kind of crazy to think about. And not surprisingly, this industry was absolutely dominated by women. It was one of the only industries that was dominated by women, to be honest. Today, we're talking about 19th century specifically. And in 1881, 1.6 million women, so that was 35% of the female population in the UK, they worked in domestic service. And I know we're like, okay, you know, they worked 12 to 15 hour days, they were exhausted, they were absolutely mistreated, they were living in poor conditions, they were probably harassed, they had no free time, they had no private life, completely miserable. But at the same time, I personally think it's important to remember that for many women, it was one of the only opportunities for independence and work that was relatively safe. I can imagine there were many young women in a position where they couldn't really afford not to work, but they wanted a job that would still allow them to be respected by the society, and maybe a job that was not very deadly, preferably. So the text that we're reading today was written for women like these, for women that were seeking independence and employment, for women who just came to the conclusion that, you know, from all of the options, being a domestic servant seems dignified enough. I think also some people back then considered domestic service an appropriate job for young ladies because it could, you know, prepare them for marriage. So today we're reading Instructions in Household Matters, or The Young Girl's Guide to Domestic Service, 1845, that was published in London. And it was, I mean, that's what the cover says. It was written by a lady with an especial view to young ladies intended for service on leaving school. So from my understanding, this was aimed at girls probably in their late teens that have just attended school. So they had some education, but domestic service was still their best option, or maybe just something they wanted. The duties of a domestic servant. Girls who intend to earn their livelihood as domestic servants will do well to learn beforehand something of the duties required of them, in order that when they begin service, they may not suffer from the evils which entire ignorance of our duties always produces. For instance, it will be convenient to know the names and uses of the various pieces of furniture, and of many other things which are not found in their own homes, as well as the means of keeping such things in order. I actually never thought about this, that if you came from a small household and then you ended up in a massive house as a member of staff, how did you know what was going on? Like, you never saw, even it mentions pieces of furniture, you never saw these pieces of furniture, you never saw these appliances. You lived in much simpler conditions, so this book could be useful to someone that was completely ignorant of what was going on because of the circumstances that they were brought up in. Houses are of various sizes, some large and containing many rooms, others small and having few rooms. The largest houses are inhabited by the richer people, moderate-sized houses by persons moderately rich, and smaller houses by those of humbler means. Okay, Captain Obvious, we get it. The mistress of the house, and in some families the housekeeper, directs the servants and sees that they properly perform their duties. Okay, this is something that I think we rarely think about, is that all of those women that were like, oh, they were just rich and wearing nice clothes and they weren't doing anything, they were running massive households. I mean, obviously they were not doing the physical work themselves, but the management, they were basically managers of their houses. They were the ones hosting parties. If you ever hear like, oh, there was this famous ball, that was all women. Men did not organize events. That was women. Women were responsible for the social circles. Women were responsible for hosting dinners, making sure the menu is appropriate. They were doing all of that. And probably the bigger the house, the bigger the responsibilities, because you had like 100 people under that you had to manage. And that's when the housekeeper sort of walked in, because I'm assuming in the bigger households, that's what the housekeeper was doing to sort of offload the mistress. But either way, she was very involved in the matters of the house. But of course, the actual work was done by the servants. Many persons keep but one servant, who is called a maid of all work, because she has many different kinds of work to do. She has to light fires, to cook, to clean, scrub floors, to make beds, to wait, to wash dishes, cups and saucers and spoons, to clean saucepans, candlesticks and stoves, and sometimes even to help the children. This seems a great deal for one person to undertake, and it certainly requires industry, attention, forethought, and regularity. All I'm thinking when I'm reading all these tasks and like how one person was supposed to do it, I'm like, this is kind of what we do nowadays. I mean, I'm not saying their work was not difficult, because it was, but it's more about how we are expected to do a lot of work and it's supposed to feel normal, when in the past you hired people to do it because it was so much. And obviously it's gotten a bit easier with all the household appliances that we now have, but basically, they're describing an average day of a stay-at-home mom, and they're like, this seems a great deal for one person to undertake. They do acknowledge that it was basically a job for many people that was done by this one maid. In some houses, several housemaids are kept, and more than one cook, also a kitchen maid or scullion, whose business it is to clean the utensils used in cookery, to wash the plates and dishes, to assist the cook, and to clean the kitchens. The kitchen maid's place is a good situation for a girl to begin with who wishes to be a cook, since she sees cookery and after a time assists in it, and thus has the opportunity of learning a great deal. In large houses, there are laundry maids who wash and iron the linen, dairy maids who milk the cows and make butter and cheese, nursery maids who attend the children, ladies' maids who dress, wait upon, and do needlework for the ladies of the family, and the housekeeper who directs all the maid servants and overlooks the rooms and furniture. She is a sort of second mistress and is to be obeyed accordingly. So they're saying that you should treat the housekeeper same as the mistress, basically. She is like the absolute boss. Then they give a description of different jobs that you had to do as you worked in service. And there is a lot of stuff that they're talking about. You had to clean a stove, you had to make a bed. There is instructions for each of this, but I'm going to omit it because it's just not that interesting. How to sweep a bed chamber, to scrub a floor, sweep a carpeted room, dust furniture, take care of papers, how to prepare linen for the wash, how to treat china and cups and saucers and all that stuff, how to wash plates. You know, there is a lot of stuff that they're talking about. What I find interesting, and this one I'm going to read, is they describe waiting at a table. So basically, that was sort of, it was kind of similar to being a waiter today, but probably treated with even less respect than waiters get nowadays, which I think is ridiculous. There's this weird power dynamic. I don't know why. It always feels a little bit awkward when someone waits on you. I know they're getting paid, but somehow it just feels awkward because I'm like, you know, I could have taken the plate myself, and it feels so strange to have someone just do it for me. It's a bit archaic, I think. Weirdly, I don't know. It just feels very old-fashioned. So every time someone waits on me, I'm always like, doing my best to make them feel comfortable, but I feel like I'm making it worse. It's kind of strange. So back then you had to wait on your boss, basically, right? You had to wait on the family that you worked for, and that was every meal. Every morning, after the breakfast things have been washed, the beds made, and the chambers arranged, the dinner tray should be prepared. So they prepared the dinner tray in the morning. That was sort of the planning that they were down for. Let the salt cellars be filled and the salt laid smooth at top, the cruets replenished when required with vinegar, pepper, and mustard, the bread basket, trays, and waiters wiped, and all the things needed at dinner so arranged that they may be readily carried into the dining room. The preparation of the dinner table varies according to the condition and habits of a family. You will probably, on first going to service, live where the habits are simple and dinner company only received occasionally. In such cases, the daily dinner usually consists of a joint of meat, hot or cold, with vegetables and a pudding or tart, and sometimes the addition of fish or soup. This is such an English dinner. Every time I'm reading classic literature, most of which is British, they're always like, oh, he was hungry, so he ate like two slices of cold meat. And I'm like, honey, you know you lived in a time of moderate prosperity. You were not starving. Like, you are not working class. You could easily eat something better. And then all of the historical recipes are also always so lame, and so they don't sound good. And I think it may have something to do with the fact that they did not really use spices, first of all, but second of all, with all sorts of strange meats and fats that do not sound too appealing to me. So maybe that's why. You will prepare the table by dusting it and then spreading the cloth neatly so that it is perfectly square with the sides and ends of the table. Having brought into the room the dinner tray, arranged as directed above, place the salt cellars at the corners of the table with a tablespoon on each side of them. Then put a knife and fork, a dessert spoon, a tumbler, wine glass, and a piece of bread for each person about to dine. The plates should be warm and changed after fish. The knives and forks also. Interesting, so they didn't want things to smell fishy, okay. Small plates and knives and forks are required for pudding, tarts, and cheese. These are put on the table when the meat is removed. Take care that the plates are thoroughly warm, but not hot. A very hot plate put suddenly into a person's hands frequently causes much discomfort. To put it mildly, like, you could literally burn your boss's hands. But no, it causes much discomfort. I love when Victorians talk about stuff in this like very subtle way when it's clearly not subtle. I find it interesting that they eat meats first and then they eat the pudding and tarts and cheese, because I feel like nowadays we have a tendency of having a lot on our table at once, or maybe I'm completely wrong. When asked for beer, water, or bread, carry it to the left hand of the person on whom you are waiting and make use of a small waiter for glasses. So I was confused about what the waiter is. Apparently it's like a tray, I think. When the dinner is removed, collect the dirty spoons and knives and forks in a tray and the glasses, salt cellars, and cruets on a waiter. Take from the room as much as you can carry at one time without risk of breaking. But never pile the things one upon another or huddle dirty and clean together. Okay, never pile the things one upon another. This sounds like a very long time to clean a table then. Unless, you know, there is a lot of people that are doing the same thing and you're just taking one plate each. I'm actually not sure about this method. But I'm assuming it was to avoid maybe making noise or drawing attention to yourself or then accidentally breaking the stuff. Before taking off the cloth, remove all crumbs of bread with a brush. As soon as you have taken out the tablecloth, shake it well and put it into the napkin press. After dinner, wash up the glasses and the plates and put them in their respective places. The great excellence of a good waiter is to be quick, to be quiet, to be attentive. To spill nothing, to break nothing, to throw nothing down. I'm sorry. I thought about the other way of throwing it down. To make no bustle, to see what is required, and not keep anyone waiting. To have everything that will be needed in the room, to avoid running in and out. Okay, I mean, that seems solid advice for a Victorian maid. It's interesting how obsessed they were with the staff being completely invisible. And this is something that they also mention in the next paragraph, which I find really interesting. One other caution is necessary. The guests at a dinner table usually converse, and their conversation is mostly amusing and likely to entertain a servant as well as themselves. But if the servant attends to what is passing among the dinner party, the business of waiting will not go on well. A servant must therefore endeavor to hear only what is addressed to herself. When I started reading this paragraph, I thought they're gonna be like, you're not one of them. You can listen, but don't laugh because you're not supposed to hear what they're saying. But what what they're actually saying is, you're gonna get distracted. The jokes are gonna be really good. You're gonna get distracted, girl. Don't listen. Focus on what you're doing and maybe only listen when they're calling your name. They also have some economical hints. So this is hints on how to save money for the household and not be wasteful. One of the most important household rules is not to eat new bread, for it is expensive and unwholesome and does not afford near so much nourishment as bread 2 or 3 days old. 100% disagree. I hate this. I feel like generations have been traumatized by this rule where you buy or get or make fresh bread that smells like heaven and your mom's like, yeah, but we still have the old bread that we're gonna eat first. This is a never-ending cycle of trauma because you have to eat the old bread, so by then the new bread turns old. And like, when am I gonna eat the new bread? When is that gonna happen? But then they also have a solution for that. Stale rolls, or bread of any kind, may be made to taste like new by dipping them in cold water and heating them in an oven or toasting them. I was way too old when I learned this, I have to admit. There have been several breads that have gone to waste in my household because I thought there is no way to save them. This is so simple, especially for bread that's not like completely old, but like maybe a little bit unfresh, let's say. But also, I don't know what it is about breads nowadays, but they get moldy so quick and my flat is really dry. So I don't know how that's happening. When the steam from a tea kettle appears cloudy, it should be taken off the fire, as the water is then fast boiling away. The steam when the water first boils being quite transparent, so as scarcely to be seen near the mouth of the spout. Literally never paid attention to this. Is that true? Is there a scientist that's listening? How does it work? I mean, it kind of makes sense because I guess it evaporates quicker when it's already boiling, but huh? Floor cloth is convenient to put at the end of a kitchen table, as the dirt and grease of saucepans that may be set upon it can be better removed from floor cloth than wood. Yeah, that makes sense that you should put something underneath the saucepans before you take them off the fire. Thick straw mats are useful to set stew pans or saucepans on, and an iron stand or a wooden barred frame should be provided to place under hot saucepans in a leaden sink. Okay. Why would you place a pot in a sink? I don't know. I'm not a Victorian maid. Maybe they were onto something. Wet clothes should never be left to dry in a sleeping room or in an inhabited apartment, as they make the air in it damp and unhealthy. This always pissed me off a little because, okay, cool if you have a laundry room. Most people don't. I mean, most people I know don't. And when you're a poor student and your clothes just never freaking dry, you are going to put them in your room because that's the only way you can get your jeans dry. That's what I did when I was a student. So I didn't really have a different place to put them in. That was like either that or I'm just going to wear wet clothes. Then there is a chapter called Useful Receipts, which is basically recipes for some household cleaning methods and stuff. I must admit, I'm not familiar with most of those, so I don't know if there is actually like some chemical background to it or if it's just like Victorian hoax, basically. So if you're a scientist, again, I hope we have at least one scientist that's listening. Tell us in the comments if it has any sort of substance to it. To remove grease spots, rub some of the yolk of an egg upon the spot. Place over it a piece of white linen and wet it with boiling water. Rub the linen with the hand, each time applying fresh boiling water. Then remove the linen and wash the part with clean cold water. Does that make sense? It doesn't really make sense to me. I don't think there is any chemical component in an egg yolk that could remove grease spots, but maybe I'm completely wrong. To take wax out of cloth. That, I'm assuming, happened a lot since they used a lot of candles and waxy things. Hold a red-hot iron steadily within about an inch of the cloth, and in a few minutes the wax will evaporate. Then rub the cloth with whitish paper to remove any mark that may remain. Again, this is not something that I would consider successful in removing wax. I mean, I know that there are methods where you have a piece of paper and you do use iron, but usually you don't hold it above the material. You just hold it against the fabric. But I've never tried this one. Maybe it does work, actually. Okay, this one. To destroy cockroaches, etc. Poisoned wafers are made for killing cockroaches. A trap is made with a glass well for the same purpose. But a more simple contrivance is to half fill a glazed basin or pie dish with sweetened beer or linseed oil and set in places frequented by cockroaches. They will attack the red wax of sealed bottles but will not touch black wax. Why would they eat wax? I know nothing about cockroaches, to be honest. And thank God for that. Let it stay that way. I don't want to get acquainted with cockroaches at all. Now this one, I don't understand why would you want... I mean, did you ever have like a lot of crickets in your house? Because usually I feel like it's just a one that jumps into your window. But they apparently had a beef with crickets because to destroy crickets at night, set dishes or saucers filled with the grounds of beer or tea on the kitchen floor. And in the morning, the crickets will be found dead from excessive drinking. So basically, get those crickets drunk. They made the crickets drunk and they killed them that way. Okay, go off, Victorians. Then we have a chapter on good manners, which is usually a bit cringy because it's like, okay, be timid, don't say anything, be nice to whoever is not nice to you, and it's just a bit annoying. But here it tells you specifically about good manners for servants. Good manners belong to no one class of people. They may be practiced by everybody. It is an error to suppose that they are expected only from rich, high-born persons, or from those who have much time and money bestowed upon their education. There are some few habits which offend against good manners. There is certainly no great harm in them, but as they are disagreeable to other people, according to the rules here laid down, namely, to respect the feelings of others, they ought to be corrected. It is uncouth to walk heavily, to bang doors, to leave them open when you quit a room, to talk in a loud voice, and to shout in laughing. There are certain habits to be avoided at meals, namely eating fast, filling the mouth over full, and speaking with it when full, making any unnecessary noise with the teeth and lips, or placing the arms and elbows on the table. It is necessary for servants to avoid such habits and to observe the rules of conduct which produce good manners. What's strange to me is that none of these habits would be visible to your employer. Like, literally, they would not know that you eat with your mouth open because they would not see that. They would not ever see you eating. So that's something I don't really get. But, you know, it's not a bad idea to have good manners, I guess. I don't know why people have such beef with savoir vivre these days. Like, you know, it's not going to hurt you to not put your legs on the bus seat. Okay, and then we have a chapter that's called A Few Words on Dress, which is obviously, if you're following my channel, you're going to know that this is the part that's the most interesting to me because fashion. So how did servants look in 1840s? I have to admit, this is not the typical Victorian servant look that you're used to. That emerged by the end of the century, sort of 1880s, 1890s, and lasted well until the First World War, or even 1920s maybe. So this whole uniform that you're thinking of with like the black dress and the white accessories, this was A, reserved to like the rich households only because the less well-off ones did not really care what the servants were wearing. And B, that's way later. So back in the 1840s, this was still sort of loose. You didn't really have exact rules as to what to wear as a servant. And I think this is what the author alludes to here, because she's trying to be like, be respectful in your choices, because you are going to make choices with your clothing. You are still allowed to do that, unlike your later versions of servants. So be sensible about it. With regard to dress, a servant has two points to attend to: neatness and economy. A servant's dress should be suited for her work. If she buy finery, it will be of no use to her. She will only lay out a certain sum to look genteel as she considers it. But this is a mistake, for finery is not gentility. Those persons only are genteelly dressed whose attire is suitable. I mean, she has a good point. If you dressed above your station and then you work as a servant, back then it would probably be considered in bad taste and it will be like, watch what you're doing because you don't want to look better than your employers because they're going to get pissed at you. So you had to certainly be careful about the clothing choices that you made because you did not want to draw attention to yourself and you did not want the mistress of the house or any women in the house be annoyed at you dressing well because they might fire you, basically. That's how I think it went down back then. The servant who during her dirty work has on a dark gown, a plain cap, and a pair of stout shoes, and a blue apron, and who, when her rough work is over, puts on a simple net cap with a quiet colored ribbon, a clean cotton or stuff gown, and a white apron, is as genteel in her situation as the mistress of the house in hers. This is interesting because it's basically like an unspoken sumptuary law. So there were, I think, no laws back then in 1840s regarding what people could wear, considering their station and their occupation and their social situation. But apparently that was still sort of perceived by people. You didn't have to have those written down as laws, but people would still think badly of you if you dressed too well. Good taste may be exercised in the choice of suitable and becoming colors and patterns. Good and useful things may also be pretty. A good useful gown, when out of repair or grown a little shabby, may be mended or taken into common wear. But finery can only be thrown away, or worn with its faded, trumpery, uncomfortable look. And how can such an appearance be called genteel? Neatness and propriety are the truest gentility. I'm curious as to what she refers to as finery, because I'm assuming she means clothes that are A, fashionable, and B, maybe decorative, like they have a lot of stuff going on. But I'm not sure why she says that a fine gown would have to be thrown away or worn with its faded, trumpery, uncomfortable look. So she must mean like fashionable gowns that you can tell were fashionable like 2 years ago, 2 years after, because I don't think there were any gowns back then that you could not mend and readjust and make it work years after. But maybe if something was clearly like a current trend, it aged pretty badly and it aged very quickly. Maybe that's what she means. Accustom yourself in early youth to repair your clothes and to make them last as long as possible. Let your undergarments be as neat and whole as your upper clothing. There are two old sayings well worth remembering and observing. A stitch in time saves nine. A penny saved is a penny got. This is very good. This is actually annoyingly good advice because I'm the one that does not do a stitch in time. I'm the one that does nine stitches after when it's already like completely broken. And because I wear a lot of vintage clothing, they do tend to break a lot and I do tend to ignore it. Like recently I had this serious meeting with like a government official and I wore my black jacket because I was like, that's the most like neutral and elegant thing I own. And like in the middle of it, I noticed that I have a huge rip under my arm. But luckily because the lining was black as well, you could not really tell. But I was like, this is kind of unprofessional, is it not? Clothes that are mended as they require it will take less time in the repairing. Okay, don't call me out like that. Why did you have to mention me? And last much longer than those which are neglected or worn as long as they will hold together. Okay, shut up. Thus, stitches and pens will be spared and saved and earned. Mind your business, lady. Like, I'm gonna walk around with my armpit completely torn. Let your workbox or bag be properly fitted up with needles, cotton, and tape, and keep them in such order that they are always ready for use. When you buy a gown, take care that you have a piece left for repairs. This is brilliant advice, actually. And I'm kind of sad that this is not a common practice nowadays, just to like add a piece of fabric that the dress or the garment was made of to the garment so you can fix it in case it like tears or something happens. Or even if they added bigger pieces, so then you could maybe widen it as your body changes, that would be honestly perfect, because the amount of times I bought a vintage piece and the skirt was a little short, but they folded a mass amount of fabric in the hem, so then I could just lengthen it and it's perfect for me. You know, they were a lot more adjustable. And I'm assuming they're talking about a case where you had a gown made for you, because obviously back then you didn't just go to a shop and picked a gown. Take care that you have a piece left for repairs is very good advice. I think I only do it when I make my own clothes. I usually leave the fabric leftovers just in case something happens, just in case my body changes, so I can maybe mend it or adjust it years after. A good plain bonnet ribbon that will last a summer will be cheaper in the end than a trimming that easily spoils, even at double the price. And though artificial flowers in your bonnet or cap may appear very smart, and other girls wear them, remember that the money it costs will produce future comforts if put in the savings bank. What kind of advice is that? Like, this is the only time she mentions money and financial issues. She's like, remember that when you buy artificial flowers, you could actually save up that money. But anything else, you go, girl. But artificial flowers are actually, that's a no-no. That's where I draw the line. A poor boy in a workhouse once told a lady his sister wore artificial flowers. He could scarcely have uttered a more severe reproach upon that sister. What a weird beef that is. Your wages will be earned laboriously. Let them be spent wisely. Okay, that's good advice, but also let a girl live. Like, if she wants flowers under her hat, it's not the end of the world. This is all. I think I have a problem because books like that where everything is centered around a particular job or a particular activity and everything is so neatly described to you, I fall for that fantasy. I'm like, wow, like being a maid in a Victorian house, imagine that. Like, I know it's bad, but at the same time, it sounds so interesting. I think it's just my problem with wanting to time travel, because obviously I would not want to be a Victorian maid. It was a horrifically hard job. And probably for a young girl in a Victorian house, it was also dangerous in terms of the people that came in, the possibility of being harassed, the mistreatment that you got from the people that there was a power imbalance with you and them. But at the same time, I kind of want to see it. Like, I really want to go to that Victorian kitchen and see how efficient and fast and hardworking they were and the sort of system that they had together. It's just, I don't know, it's just interesting because I think it's also because you don't really get to hear those stories. You only get books like these where it's like how to be a good servant so your employer is happy, but you rarely get to hear those people's stories and what actually went on downstairs, apart from like the recipes or the rules set in the house, but you never actually get to hear those people's experiences. And I feel like we're missing a lot. I think, you know, a day in a Victorian household where I could just watch them work, that would do it. That would do it. Only a day. I don't want to live there. It's horrific. I would die. But a day, count me in. So that's my hot take of the day. Anyway, that's the end of this episode. If you want to support the podcast, head to patreon.com/textree. I don't have a website. What the hell? But also, in more important news, remember that from now on, new episodes of the podcast will be on YouTube, not on my channel. It will be on a separate YouTube channel called Textree the Podcast. So head there, subscribe, and do all the stuff that you need to do to be up to date with the newest episodes. So thanks for listening, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!